Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. Abe Greenwald, sitting to my left, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And to my right, not necessarily metaphorically, Noah Rothman, our assistant online editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
So this is the third week of August 2016, and the news of the week is, or ought to be, that Hillary Clinton is yet again in email trouble and Clinton Foundation trouble, and that the two are at last, long last, dovetailing, that the email trouble involves the Clinton Foundation and new proof of the unholy and highly questionable relationship between the two. Most especially, I think, the evidence that the Prime Minister of Bahrain, or the Foreign Minister of Bahrain, I can't remember which, looking to have an appointment with Hillary Clinton, went not through State Department channels, but to the Clinton Foundation, to which he was a $5 or $10 million donor. And the Clinton Foundation's Doug Band sent an email to Huma Abedin, her aide at the State Department, and miraculously the appointment was made. Now, shouldn't be that hard for a senior official of a friendly Arab potentate to get in to see the Secretary of State for 15 minutes, but the fact that it was known to him that he would do better going through this private channel to get her attention rather than through the public channel of contacting the embassy, his embassy contacting the protocol officer at the State Department, the request going up the chain, suggests the degree to which the world knew that the Clinton Foundation was a conduit to the Secretary of State. Not that we knew, or not that they did, or not that they didn't, but that the world outside the United States understood that by giving money to the Clinton Foundation, this was a way of buying yourself a back channel to the Secretary of State's office. Abe?
Yeah, it's an excellent point. It's like a sort of schmooze channel. You know, this is the way to really to get in there, you know. And of course, as these things come up, then tying into the email story, so people say, well, but there's no sort of, where's the smoking gun, you know, that people wouldn't have been appointed anyway, that serious favors were undertaken that wouldn't have been undertaken anyway. And of course, that's where the emails come in. If we don't have all the emails, then we don't know that there may or may not be a smoking gun, and there may never be one.
But the preponderance, well, I mean, you're never going to see that here. This is us helping you because you
write
donated to the Clinton.
Write a check, and I will make an appointment. Right. Or Hillary saying, Huma, make sure that he writes a $10 million check to the foundation and hires Bill as a consultant, and then I will give him 30 minutes of my time, and we will take office space in his building in Caracas.
Right.
That's not going to happen.
Right. But the preponderance of evidence at this point suggests that what we all knew to be the case was that, as you say, schmooze channel was the case. We have these before this week. We had last week the emails that suggested Doug Band over at the Clinton Foundation and Cheryl Mills, actually, who was not associated with the Clinton Foundation at all, was Hillary Clinton's chief of staff, longtime Clinton correspondent, or rather confidant, was assisting a Nigerian-Lebanese businessman in seeking contact with the ambassador to Lebanon at the time. This was, again, through his contacts at the Clinton Foundation. This kind of moiety that was supposed to exist between these two stations simply didn't. You have Ukrainian businessman Viktor Pinchuk, who is a longtime friend of Bill Clinton's, a prolific donor to the Clinton Foundation. We learned last year that he wanted to do some business with Iran while the sanctions were in place. The sanctions were supposed to be enforced by the State Department and conspicuously were not. We know all about the uranium deal that was under review in the White House and the State Department at the same time that this corporation that was later to become a Russian-owned corporation was donating to the Clinton Foundation. There are mountains of evidence now that suggests that the Clinton Foundation and the State Department under Hillary Clinton were one in the same, and that is a level of corruption that should be punishable, if not legally, then than politically.
Look, we know a couple of things. We know that Cheryl Mills signed some kind of a document with the White House. Obviously not a document of legal standing, but some kind of like golden...
The ethics golden memorandum. Honor,
an ethics memorandum.
That was Bruce Lindsay and Valerie Jarrett.
Right. So Bruce Lindsay, by the way, who was White House counsel under Bill Clinton and Valerie Jarrett and then Cheryl Mills, so they have this document that says you have to keep the foundation and the State Department separate, and Cheryl Mills signs it, and now we know that she went and interviewed candidates to run the Clinton Foundation, and that there were, in the course of 2 years, at least 158 emails exchanged between Cheryl Mills and the executive director of the Clinton Foundation, which is about 2 a week if you take out vacations and things like that. So this is not a casual relationship. This is a constant form of contact. And the issue with the foundation, as with things like Bill Clinton's speaking fees and consultancy deals during the time that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, all have to do with not whether or not there was a specific quid pro quo in which you gave X dollars to get Y policy or access, but that this was a way of staying in the good graces of a person who was Secretary of State and who was, even in 2009, if we want to go back and remember, even then thought of as the likely or very possible next president of the United States after Barack Obama. So getting on her good side, having an organization that made it possible to get on the good side of somebody who was managing American foreign policy and might be the next president, was a cheap insurance policy for the future. And that, the question you have to ask yourself is the degree to which that was a conscious understanding on the part of the foundation and the people who ran it, meaning Bill and Hillary Clinton themselves, that they were establishing a line of income buying future access, not present access, not even access that was going to have any particular payback, just access. And once again, we see how, if you look at all of this and you can put it together using all the evidence and the relevant information that we have, a case that is prosecuted against her in public properly would be incredibly damaging to her. Part of what strikes me as interesting, as I say in a column in the New York Post today, is that Hillary is a terrible liar. Like, she can't, she, they never, they set this up, all this is going on, she's never been able to spin out a convincing refutation of the argument that I just made. Except to say it's not true, 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 it's all just a right-wing conspiracy. Well, that is preposterous. Good government practices like this were put into place in the 1970s largely as a response by Watergate liberals like Hillary Rodham to misbehavior on the part of the committee to reelect the president in 1972, the Nixon reelection campaign. And all kinds of sunshine laws and all kinds of new ethics rules and all kinds of ethics regulations, which were a creation of the very political movement that gave birth to Hillary Rodham Clinton's political career. So for her to plead, if there's, you know, smoke doesn't mean fire and you can't prove it, that was never necessary. Proof was not the point was that the U.S. government was supposed to be like Caesar's wife. Otherwise, you know, beyond unimpeachable and clean beyond all measure, because the appearance of corruption would be destructive to the common world order.
And, you know, I think the amazing thing about her lack of a response or a coherent attempt at a defense of this speaks to the fact that she never in a billion years thought this was going to be uncovered, and which I think speaks to her sense of entitlement and sort of ability to control things.
She might have thought that, but her allies didn't. And we have emails that suggest now that they knew that this foundation was going to be dug up and investigated thoroughly because she was always going to run for president again. Everybody
right.
around
but,
knew that.
Right, but that's another of the jokes of this, which is that last week when the first big revelation came out, which was that she had told the FBI in the unsworn interview that she did with them in July that she got the idea for setting up a private server from former Secretary of State Colin Powell, who told this to her at a dinner party. Before Powell even started biting back and saying, you're trying to pin this on me, and the conversation or the exchange that we had about this took place a year after you set up the server, the first response of her defenders was to say, nobody should even be seeing this deposition. It was just given over as a result of a subpoena to Congress, and someone at Congress leaked it to the New York Times, and no one should be seeing this. So right there is Abe's point, which is that effectively, as I said, this is like the line that Scooby-Doo villains use at the end of the cartoon, which is, I would have gotten away with it too if it weren't for you meddling kids at the New York Times getting a leak
right.
from somebody.
Right, right.
That doesn't address the substance of it. The substance of it is that the future, very likely future president of the United States, in a testimony to the FBI, lied about how she got the idea to set up her private server. Lied. She lied. It's not an untruth. It's not a prevarication. She lied. Powell, by the way, is now backed up in his contention that at this dinner party where she claims he told her that he had used AOL for his private email from 2001 to 2005, Condoleezza Rice, Powell's successor as Secretary of State, was at the same dinner, and she now says she has no recollection of any such conversation. So that makes two people present saying the conversation didn't happen. And if there were a court of law and you were asking, that's not he said, she said, that she said, and then two witnesses that say that it was not said.
Now,
that's really bad.
FBI Director James Comey told Congress in testimony that they had no reason to believe that Hillary Clinton lied to them in their interview. But we don't have a verbatim transcript of that exchange. There was no transcript taken. So we'll never be able to prove definitively that Hillary Clinton misled the FBI.
Besides which, so Hillary goes to the FBI. She gives this interview. And a week later, Comey comes out and issues the I'm not going to indict her for anything line. It's now clear that she said various things in the interview, and it would appear very unlikely that the FBI then went and followed up, like went to Colin Powell and said, Hillary Clinton says X happened. Did it happen? And if then Colin Powell had said to the FBI, no, that didn't happen, right there you have a case for perjury. Now, it's not maybe not perjury explicitly, because apparently the testimony was not sworn, but there is an implicit sense that if you talk essentially to authorities and tell them a bald-faced untruth.
If any of us were interviewed by an FBI agent and told them a lie, we would be summoned
right.
to
so,
have an actually on-the-record under oath testimony.
So what Comey apparently did was he took what she said in that interview, and as long as it wasn't disagreed with by any prior evidence that they had put together, he then said that she was clear. But what we have evidence now is that she added details and embellishments, one of which at least is now clearly factually a lie. She's not going to get indicted for it. There's not going to be a special prosecutor for any of this. But here we are in the middle, almost at the end of August, and the Democratic candidate for president has been exposed lying with an unimpeachable. The point about Colin Powell is when people said, well, Colin Powell is now saying that this wasn't true. We all expect Colin Powell is going to vote for Hillary Clinton. Colin Powell voted for Barack Obama twice. He's basically a liberal. Nominally a Republican, he's not going to vote for Donald. There's no way. He's already said Donald Trump is a racist. He has no dog in this fight to attack Hillary Hillary Clinton, like he's going to vote for her probably.
Yeah, he's not part of the vast right-wing
conspiracy.
So
on Twitter, when her apologists come at me on Twitter, they say things like, well, Colin Powell said there were WMDs in Iraq, which is also an interesting spin since Hillary Clinton said there were WMDs in Iraq. So if we are not to believe Powell, we can also then use the same standard not to believe Hillary.
As for the Clinton Foundation, which is now becoming a liability, one of the defenses that you always heard from its defenders was that this is a really altruistic humanitarian organization upon whom lives depend. It really is saving lives in and around the third world. And that's arguably difficult to disprove. At the same time, however, its
well,
defenders...
you can disprove it in this way, which is that we know that it completely mishandled the aftermath of the earthquake in Haiti, and that there are very serious aid officials and people who understand this who believe that the Clinton Foundation's incompetence and malfeasance led to the spread of virulent diseases in the wake of the Haiti earthquake that killed thousands of people.
And there are charitable watchdogs that have simply declined to offer an assessment of how the Clinton Foundation does business because it is so unique in its structure. Mm-hmm. But that all being said, even those who agree with the notion that this is an indispensable altruistic organization are saying that it has to go, including the editorial board of the Boston Globe, which is by no means Republican-friendly, and a longtime Hillary friend and associate, former DNC chair and Philadelphia mayor and Pennsylvania governor Ed Rendell, all of whom are
not
saying...
Not to mention James Carville, who said somebody at the Clinton Foundation is going to go to hell. for the way they handled this. And David Axelrod, who is, of course, Obama's guy, not Hillary's guy, said, Mrs. Clinton should not be acting so flip about all this. Like, she made jokes about this on Jimmy Kimmel's late night show on ABC. And Axelrod said on CNN this morning that it was a terrible mistake for her to act as though this is something she can laugh about. The last thing on earth she should be doing is laughing about her emails and about the behavior of the Clinton Foundation.
But these people are not saying that this foundation needs to be handed over to a proper steward or broken up, or that its work is so important that it needs to continue. They are saying explicitly that it has to dissolve because there is no way to divorce the appearance of impropriety from people who donate to this organization and what Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State or possibly a future president does. And that's a really interesting admission. If they're saying that there's altruism in the world, and if you are really genuinely philanthropic, you can satisfy your desire to donate to other organizations. So this organization that was once indispensable is now no longer so indispensable. What purpose does it serve then in its current constitution, its current form, if not to just advance the interests of the Clintons?
Well, I'll give you another example of an interesting effort to spin your way out of this, which is that James Carville said again, I think this morning, how come nobody made a big deal of it when Bob Dole was Senate Majority Leader and his wife Liddy was head of the American Red Cross? Now, that's an astonishing thing to say because the American Red Cross is a 140-year-old organization with a gigantic endowment and a huge revenue stream that is entirely self-creating and self- And there, aside from the fact that, you know, people at the Red Cross have over time mishandled money for their own uses, they've gotten caught at it and fired, but that, you know, Carville should be pulling out of thin air the idea that Liddy Dole had, you know, that somehow the American Red Cross needed the wife of the Senate Majority Leader because it was peddling influence in Washington to collect blood and to help disaster victims, just gives you a sense of how corrupting the world of spin is and how the demand to spin then just means you can say anything about anybody and you can slander anybody simply in service of a soundbite for that minute or minute and a half.
And also, let's not forget the other purpose that the Clinton Foundation served all these years. It was not only this sort of, you know, house of influence peddling, but it also kept that and built up the Clinton brand, kept it alive for all these years. They were these sort of, you know, the first family of, you know, global charities, but they spun books out of it, and this kept the whole Clinton myth going while it was also serving as his clearinghouse.
And a dual revenue stream. This is what's also important, because from 2001 to 2013, Bill Clinton was a machine generating about $200 million in personal income, right, as an ex-president. But that wasn't all the money that he could raise. So there was a separate revenue stream. He could go to people and say, look, you can pay me $5 million to do this, and then put $5 million into my foundation also. So you get him, and then you get a tax deduction for the money, not obviously the government of Bahrain, the government's outside, which is the Hillary issue. But you got two ways to give money to Bill Clinton to buy his good faith and Hillary's good faith. And remember again that Hillary Clinton is a senator from New York, and the minute that she becomes senator from New York, she's already a possible future presidential candidate. So when you're giving money to the Clinton Foundation from 2001 to 2008, you're not just buying friendship with Bill Clinton, and you are buying, again, potential future access to the next president of the United States after George W. Bush. She didn't make it, so she'll be in 2016. It is, you know, part of this incredible, you know, Roger Simon in our July-August issue had a piece called about moral narcissism, in which he says that the guiding doctrine of the left has become, or of liberalism has become, you're good because you think you want good things, and therefore wanting good things and preaching good things makes you good, as though the two are not entirely inseparable in terms of personal conduct. And here you have the perfect example of that, which is that you go to Bill Clinton, you go to Hillary Clinton, and you say, you're a crook. What do you look the way you're behaving? And they're like, what are you talking about? I'm raising money to help people in Africa with AIDS. It's like, you know what? That's really great, and it's a wonderful thing. You're doing a wonderful thing. As it happens, you're piggybacking. You know, these programs already existed. You know, so you want to contribute? That's wonderful. You want to raise money for it? It's wonderful. It doesn't mean that your behavior is therefore cleansed. There's a whole George Orwell's second novel, Burmese Days, features a villain, Burmese kind of warlord villain who was trying to control everybody. And his whole idea is every time he does something bad, he says, when I reach the age of 50, I'm going to start building pagodas. And when I build pagodas, I'm going to cleanse myself. So I'm going to build pagodas. And then as it happens, he dies at 49. So he never builds the pagodas and doesn't really save his soul. So Bill and Hillary are building the pagodas as though that saves your soul when you're talking about whether or not what you were doing as a political matter inside the United States is legitimate.
So I think what you did just there is kind of boil it down to its political salience. I think what the Clintons are probably hoping for is the last 20 minutes of granular details that we were going into goes right over everybody's head, that they start hearing all these names and connections. It's all very vague, and it's sort of the implication is tawdry, but it's not sort of hard. It's difficult to prove. So everything kind of gets washed out. The worst scandal is the one you can boil down to a sentence. And I think you probably did it there, but I'm not entirely sure that anybody's going to jump on it because nobody really wants to prosecute this. Again, like we have Mitt Romney in 2012 was the worst person the Republicans could have put up to litigate the issue of Obamacare because of his work.
Romney care.
Establishing a mandate in Massachusetts. Donald Trump is probably the worst person to litigate the issue against the Clinton Foundation because of his between $100,000 and $250,000 donation to the Clinton Foundation in 2009 when Hillary Clinton was serving as Secretary of State. He simply is unable to litigate this issue. Nobody else will.
Look, I think that there's a case to be made that that all of this is baked in the cake. Hillary is an extremely unpopular politician. All this does is reinforce that. All of this happened in 2015 just as she was starting to run. The very fact of her cronyism and mercantilism and misbehavior helped give rise to the fringe candidacy that got 44, you know, wild fringe candidacy with a 74-year-old Jewish socialist from Vermont getting 44% of the Democratic primary vote. more votes in the Democratic primary than Donald Trump got in the Republican primary. Let's not forget. So it's baked in the cake. Her unpopularity, this reinforces it. Everybody who for whom this matters is aware of it. And then the question is, if you've got her this unpopular with a lot of people who should be voting for her uneasy and discomfited by her, and then you have Donald Trump on the other side in his parlous and critical situation, are we looking at an extraordinarily low turnout election where people on the left and people on the right are both going, ugh, I mean, I'm like that. I mean, what am I going to do? Like, go to the polls and hold my nose and vote for one of these people? Like, that's not how, I don't want to feel dirty. I don't want my vote to make me feel dirty. And the only reason you wouldn't have your vote feel dirty now is if you so loathe one candidate or the other that you were somehow, your vote was somehow cleansed by the fact that you were, and I think this is really the key motivation for most people who are going to vote now. You are not voting for Donald Trump. You are voting against Hillary. You are not voting for Hillary. You're voting against Donald Trump. If that number is 50, 60, 70% or more of the reason that people go out to vote, we are going to see turnout crash. Noah, the other day you pulled up some turnout figures, and they're pretty striking, right? So,
yeah, off the top of my head, I don't recall what they were.
Well, I think in 1996, turnout barely topped 50%, and it was actually, so it was at like 50.1 or 2%, and then it started to climb. It was pretty high in 2000. It went to like 54 in 2000, went to 56 or 57 in 2004. It went to 62 or 63 in 2008, yeah. And then it went down a couple points for the first time ever, by the way. I mean, that's a key detail about Obama is he got 4 million fewer votes in 2012 than he got in 2008.
I think it was about 54 or something in
something like that. Or, in 2012. Yeah, but, right. So the question now is...
Over under 50%?
Yeah, that's the question. And if it's... and
less than half the eligible population of voters turns out in this election, then you have a really ugly narrative forming about participation in American democracy being a plurality affair.
But the entire world of data-driven campaigning, the way that Donald Trump has disdained conventional metrics of campaigning, right? He's not building an organization. He's not going to get out there. He's using the RNC to do all this stuff for get out the vote and all that, represents a complete misunderstanding of what Obama did in 2012, as described by Sasha Isenberg in his extremely interesting book, The Victory Lab. What happened, the key was not in turning out voters who would mostly already have turned out, but like forgot, just having, making it more fun for them, but in turning out people who would vote for you if they went to the polls, but really weren't planning on going to the polls. We're called very weak supporters. And the genius of the Obama campaign in 2012, as was explained to me by a senior official in the Romney campaign, is that one of the reasons Romney got the numbers wrong at the end was that they were using conventional metrics, which is that a lot of Obama support, when you asked people in polls, going from 1 to 10, 10 being you would be at the polls if there were a nuclear war, and 1 being you know, if there was a raindrop, you wouldn't go where they were. And a lot of Obama voters were at 2 or 3. And conventionally, before they figured out all these ways to get people to the polls, you would knock anybody lower than 4 off and assume they were not going to vote. That's a classic metric. It was used for 30 years. That if you did the 1 to 10 scale, voters 4 and under were extremely unlikely to vote, and you wouldn't really bother with them. And you could assume that they weren't going to be there, and that your entire universe of voter was the voters who said that their likelihood of voting was between 4 and 10. And Obama got the 1s and the 2s and the 3s to turn out. And that was how he won in 2012. That's what hard data and this kind of thing and these get-out-the-vote organization systems now can do. And the Democrats have them, and Trump does not. The RNC has some, But you could see a relatively depressed Democratic turnout that is nonetheless ballasted or backboned by serious efforts of the Obama kind. And you could see a complete collapse of Republican vote because there is nobody there pushing the ones and twos and threes to vote, telling them that they'll drive them there, telling them where the polling places are, sending them a map through Waze or Google to show them how to get to the polling place, promising parking, all sorts of stuff that they did.
And yet, to hear Trump tell it, the ones and twos and threes are the ones who are going to come out and vote. That's the invisible white vote that's suddenly going to turn out.
Right. So you're saying if anybody needs that kind of extraordinarily expensive, detailed organization to ensure his victory, it's Trump, and that's precisely what he disdains.
But he's not just spouting that off on the trail, by the way. This is what his campaign staff, his ranking staffers, are telling reporters. Robert Costa at the Washington Post yesterday had a really ridiculous tweet. I mean, not him. He's a great reporter. But the tweet itself was absurd because he said that the Trump campaign strategy is literally now predicated on the word hope, quote-unquote hope. They hope that this new redefinition is going to soften his appeal among really hardened anti-Trump white voters, white women particularly, because he's doing a very sort of diplomatic offensive, but also that he's predicting unprecedented events will rescue him, an unprecedented turnout among white voters. So his strategy is predicated on a whole bunch of wishes that he's not doing anything to make manifest.
Right,
in
and
the
those
world.
Wishes, and the thing is that over the last 8 years, those wishes, there are now technical means by which you can try to make those wishes turn into reality that did not exist before. And those are precisely what he's not doing, which is what is so striking. And not only that, but so Gallup today comes out with this survey. Gallup is, because of its bad record in 2012, is not doing head-to-head polling of the 2016 campaign, isn't giving us numbers on who's winning, Trump or Clinton or whatever. But it is surveying a lot, and it has this survey of how people are doing in various demographic groups and region groups and sort of geographical groups. And according to this survey, what are called suburban and exurban voters. Suburban voters live in a ring about 10 miles distant from a city center, 10 to 20 miles distant from a city center. And the exurbans live 25 to 50 miles outside of this. So they're not rural and they're not really small towners. They're in these kind of rings, secondary rings. And theoretically, the exurbans, particularly in a lot of these, should be Trump voters, according to Trump's own description of them. And he is underperforming Romney, not only in the suburbs, which we knew, in the white suburbs, but in the exurbs. Now, you have to think about what this means. So all these polls now are showing Trump underperforming Romney in all these battleground states. North Carolina, South Carolina, which wasn't a battleground state until this year, Georgia, Missouri, which also wasn't a battleground state until this year. And here's what you have to remember when you're looking at these numbers. Romney lost by 4%. If Trump loses a Romney voter, he needs two voters to get back to 4%. For every vote Romney voter he loses, he needs two just to be at par. So he can't underperform with a single demographic group that Romney won. Period. He can't underperform. If he performs as Romney performed, he will lose by 4 percentage points. If he underperforms, the number goes down from 4 to 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. And even if he overperforms Romney in this one group, right, which is undereducated white males, there aren't, if he got 99% of them and he underperforms with women and suburbanites and exurbanites, he will not win the presidency. There aren't actually enough of them to win him the presidency.
And he's underperforming Romney in a demographic that is now a greater part of the voting public than it was when Ronald Reagan, which is educated whites.
Right, exactly.
They make up
and more, educated
they're
whites,
more important this time.
Right, and educated whites haven't gone Democratic since 1956.
Which, by the way, was the last time a Republican lost Missouri and won the White House.
Right. So we are in cloud cuckoo land in relation to this. The Trump campaign is now being run by, you know, an alt-right lunatic rich man horror named Steve Bannon, and by a professional pollster named Kellyanne Conway, an old friend of mine. And Kellyanne this morning goes on TV and says to the BBC that Trump is winning, the polls are all wrong, and that they have a secret polling methodology that is going to prove that he is going to generate all of these.
It's called unskewing.
Whiters. All these votes. No, but they have their own special, they have a thing going on. It's a project, and it will prove that he is going to win all of these white voters that are going to win him the prep. But she can't tell us what it is. It's a big secret. Because, you know, if there's one thing that polling ought to be, it's secret. Because that a secret poll is a really valuable thing. So basically, not only is Trump supporting Trump, ruining the reputations of Rudy Giuliani and Rick Perry and Chris Christie and Newt Gingrich and all these people who are now being forced to say things that betray everything that they ever believed and preached before. But Kellyanne Conway, a professional pollster, has now become somebody who says that all the polling is wrong. So what is she going to do in December when Trump loses, when she has to go out and try to sell her business? She's got four kids. You know, she needs the money. Like, how is she going to go and say, well, I just spent 3 months trashing polling. Hire me. I mean, this is the weird thing where you see, you know, Rudy Giuliani telling people to Google Hillary Clinton and health if they want to know whether or not she's sick. You know, okay, so Rudy Giuliani's, like, his political career is over. He hasn't been in an election in 14 years, 15 years. Actually, he hasn't faced voters since 1997, so it's 19 years. Gingrich hasn't faced voters. Well, I mean, they both ran for the presidency, but, like, you know, basically, you know, in forever. So they're, like, throwing their chips in to see what they might get out of it. But Kellyanne's a different story. Like, that's her, this is her bread and butter, and she is basically joining the movement that, I mean, frankly, I participated in 2012, and I'm a sadder but wiser person now. I thought that the polling in 2012 was underestimating the Republican vote, the conservative vote, and the white vote. And in fact, the polling models that said that the electorate was going to be more like 2008 and less like 2010 were correct. And, you know, I learned my lesson. And apparently professional pollsters have decided to go the other way.
Not to defend the practice of unskewing, and I wouldn't. But at the same time, at least there was some supportive evidence. We had talked about Gallup before, but Gallup was modeling an electorate that looked a lot different from every other pollster. It was saying that the electorate was going to be a lot more Republican. Quinnipiac Now has said that the electorate is going to be much whiter than a lot of the other pollsters are suggesting because of the Trump effect. At the same time, all these pollsters are saying, not Gallup because it's not doing anything in this cycle, but Quinnipiac has turned the other way and is saying that this is not a competitive race in the swing states, at least in those that are really going to matter, like Pennsylvania. So there really is no evidence to suggest that there is there's some sort of remarkable new shift in the electorate to support this theory.
Far from it. So if you look at the last 3 weeks of polling, state and nationally, Clinton versus Trump head-to-head, or Clinton versus Trump with the Libertarian Gary Johnson and the Green Jill Stein in the mix. In 93 polls, in 86 of them, and I'm talking about state level and fed, because you're not really polling in the states. No one's really polling in the states where Trump's ahead by 15 or Hillary's ahead by 15. In 93 polls in battlegrounds and nationally, Trump is ahead, and that's states and national. Trump is ahead in 6, and Hillary is ahead in 87. Now, it just simply beggars description to say that numbers like that mean that he's going to win. I mean, that is not the way it works. And as of yesterday, she is now ahead by 10 or more in polling averages in states with 293 electoral votes, thus giving her a comfortable cushion, which means that he would have to reverse polls in states with 24 electoral votes, you know, aggregate, by 10 points or more in order to get back in the game, not even to win, just to get back in the game.
And here's where another thing that Trump supporters will say in their own defense, which is going to pivot us to the next phase of this campaign, is that people don't even tune in until the fall. They don't even really watch this thing happen until Labor Day. Don't worry about anything until after Labor Day. Well, that's true. But every sign we have suggests that those who tune into this race after Labor Day are going to tune in and say Donald Trump is somebody we can't support or vote for.
It's not just that. It's a ridiculous contention now. You spent, you know, we had the fall, in the fall of 2015, in the fall of 2015, we had debates. We had nine or something Republican debates in which the average audience was 17 million people. And those weren't all the same 17 million people. It is likely that more than half the electorate, two-thirds or three-quarters of the electorate in the United States, tuned in to 10 or more minutes of a Republican debate. So the notion that what is going on in this election is largely unknown to people and that they're not paying attention is a complete fantasy. You have the most famous person ever to run for president in Donald Trump, you know, a non-politician ever to run for president, Donald Trump, and you have the most famous political figure extant of the who was not president of the last quarter century running for president on the Democratic side. They are not unknown like Dukakis was and like Bush was, even though Bush was vice president. They are not unknown like Clinton was. They are not unknown like Perot was. They are not unknown like George W. Bush was, and they are not unknown like John Kerry was, and they are not unknown like McCain and Obama were. There is no one in the United States needs to get to know Hillary Clinton, and no one in the United States needs to get to know Donald Trump. That is how they got where they got, and the notion that therefore there is going to be an introduction period from Labor Day till the 23rd of September when the first debate happens is simply science fiction.
But just add very quickly also, also the campaign up to now has been full of sensational headlines, you know, crazy stories about snubs and insults and scandals. This is not a low key boring campaign that no one is that the public has not paid attention to.
Exactly what they're going to tune in for. Is that they're not tuning in to this race. All of a sudden, we're going to be talking about taxes or healthcare policy or something mundane. The backdrop against which these people are going to be tuning into this race over the next 3 weeks is going to be race. Hillary Clinton, as of tomorrow, we are recording this on Wednesday, as of Thursday, Hillary Clinton is going to deliver a large speech, a very set-piece speech about the alt-right, about the racist element behind which Donald Trump, they've rallied behind Donald Trump, and Donald Trump has given them quarter and support and sucker. And Donald Trump is now in the process of trying to soften his appeal to minorities, and he's going to be engaging in an actual genuine racial outreach. To this stage, he's delivered something that is kind of like a half outreach that is really targeting white women more than it is minorities by saying, what have you got to lose? Your lives are a disaster. Your neighborhoods are horrible. Your decision-making process is flawed. You people are disastrous people. You should vote for me. That's not a pitch to minorities. That's really an insult to minorities, and the audience is not minorities. He's about to change that a little bit, heading into to Detroit and meeting with some Black and Latino leaders at his tower, and Hillary Clinton is going to be framing him as a racist. We're not talking about policy. We're going to be talking about something much more cultural, much more transcendent, that anybody can get behind. Anybody can understand intuitively the nature of this racial argument. And it's been a long time since racism won a national election.
But look, it's not just that. We spent a year saying Trump couldn't possibly win or might not be able to win because Romney got 27% of the Hispanic vote and Trump will get half that, and that's 4 million votes, and it's located in Florida and Texas and California, you know, Florida and a couple of places where it'll really kill him, and so he can't win. I don't think we ever really grappled with the possibility that in August of 2015, Hillary Clinton would be polling better among African Americans than Barack Obama did. I mean, we have now multiple national polls and state level polls that show Trump with 1% or fewer or less of the African American vote. Less than 1%. Now, aside from the fact that if that stays as it stays, there literally is nothing that he can do. I mean, you know, McCain got 5% of the African American vote. You know, Romney got 5%. So that's 13% of the electorate. Like, right there, if he gets 1%, you know, we could just all close up shop now. So in some sense, Noah wrote a very good post yesterday. I commend to your attention on commentarymagazine.com about how the racial outreach of the Trump campaign was really an outreach to suburban women to try to file off his rough edges so they won't say, well, I can't vote for him. He doesn't say anything nice about people, and he's not nice enough. So he's saying, you know, he cares about black people and wants their vote, and he's saying maybe he won't, you know, send out a, you know, deportation force to throw 11 million people out of the country. But still, if that number stays anywhere near where it is, you know, this election is over, but now we're focusing on this African American number. His Latino number is still below 20. Right. So again, like I said before, every vote that Romney got that he doesn't get, he's got to get two to make just to get back to even.
Amy Walter over at Cook Political Report had a really good analysis. I think about a year ago, back when we were actually still talking about the plausible pathway to a Republican victory, that said that the African-American vote is really key. We focus a lot on the Latino vote, but like a 10-point shift in the Latino vote would win Republicans the White House. Like a 4 or 5-point shift in the African-American vote would do so because of their geographic locations. They're very much, African-American voters are very much urban voters. And as a result of a teeny shift in the urban vote, you have a much bigger swing in states like Florida, like Ohio,
Michigan, Pennsylvania.
Wisconsin. These are really key to a potential Republican landslide.
Right. Or just a Republican victory.
North Carolina, South Carolina. Now, when you have Trump where he is now, polling less than 1% or 1% thereabouts among Republicans and winning, say, 10% of the white vote, the Eastern Seaboard goes blue. And that's what we're looking at.
Yeah. So basically, the situation we find ourselves in is that Hillary Clinton is a goniff and Donald Trump is an idiot, or Donald Trump is, you know, basically running an absolutely horrendously bad campaign based on ideas and concepts of how to win that are outmoded, outdated, that represent the opposite of best practices, right? I mean, the classic rule now is everyone's like, well, we're doing this, you're doing that. You want to follow best practices in every field. And best practices are you use big data, you have a data machine, you do this, you have that system, you have this system, you borrow, you know, the whole notion of how elections work is that whatever Obama did in 2012 isn't supposed to work as efficiently in 2016 because it can be duplicated by the other side since it innovated things. The innovations can be taken by the other side, and as happened with the Democrats in 2008, who took the innovations that Karl Rove came up with for Bush to generate 22% more votes in 2004 than he had in 2000, and that you could do that, and that you would eliminate that. And so Trump has done absolutely none of that. So his campaign, among every other problem that it has, is being run like a third-rate, you know, political organization that is still using dial-up. You know? I mean, not even a T1 line or, you know, just, you know, it's like it's on AOL. Yeah, it's like he's on CompuServe. It's like Prodigy. You know, it's, you know, Hillary's got Fios and he's dialing up at 360 baud to Prodigy, and we'll see how brilliantly that works. And saying, well, I'm AOL, I've got 20 million subscribers, right? Well, AOL has 20 million subscribers because there's a bunch of people who don't know now that they don't have to pay $20 a month, 2 million subscribers. They don't have to pay $20 a month for their internet access, and AOL's not going to tell them. If they're going to pay it, AOL's going to take the money. Some their children can tell them to stop. If anyone in the sound of my voice is still paying for AOL, you don't have to pay for AOL. You can still have your free address and stop paying them. Stop paying them. Cut your credit card off.
Right after this stops buffering, they're going to they're going to jump right on that.
Colin Powell is listening.
Yeah, well, but to be fair to Colin Powell, he was Secretary of State until 2005. And to be fair to AOL users, my wife is an AOL user, but she doesn't pay for it. It's just that she's had the address for 20 years. So whether you use AOL or you use whatever system that you have to get to the internet, please join our conversation at commentarymagazine.com. It's kind of a one-sided conversation because we don't have comments. We don't have comments because our comments were getting horrifically bad and anti-Semitic, and almost everybody who is commenting on our site is now commenting on Breitbart.com in the alt-right palaces of the alt-right. But as it is a one-sided conversation, nonetheless, I hope there are a multiplicity of voices and interesting perspectives. CommentaryMagazine.com, we let you have some free reads, then we ask you to pay $19.99 for a digital subscription, and $20.99 gets you all of that iPad subscription and our beautiful print monthly magazine. We have a magnificent issue coming out in a couple of days with some amazing stuff in it, including a really remarkable essay called The Secret Jews of the Hobbit by the Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, which is an eye-opening look at the fourth best-selling book ever written, J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. That and among other wonderful stuff. So I really hope that you will join us. We are probably going to be dark next week, as some of us will be on vacation. Others of us will probably have a new baby in the house, and you're probably going to be on vacation too. So we'll probably see you back here, or we'll be back talking to you after Labor Day. So thanks very much, and keep the candle burning.